Welcome, everyone. This is episode 3 of Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? I'm Ray Powell, former military officer, director of Sea Light, and I am joined by my friend and brother from another mother, Jim Caruso, former diplomat. Jim, how are you?
I'm great. I hope our mother's fine, too.
Well, I'll definitely let Mom know that you look great. I am very happy that we're able to do this third episode. We've been getting great responses from the first two. We even came in at number one on the news and commentary list in the Philippines for our podcast last week, which we did, of course, on the U.S.-Philippines-Japan trilateral. Why should we care about that? Great session. And by the way, for our listeners, please stick around at the end. We're going to try out a new feature where Jim and I basically start trading war stories. As we like to say in the military, and we're going to call this one, this feature, There I Was. So each episode, you'll get to hear an interesting or funny or compelling story from one of us as we talk about some of the things we've experienced in the military service, the foreign service. And I can tell you, there are some pretty interesting things that we've had the chance to go through. So, somebody who knows something about war stories and sea stories is our guest. As we are going into our episode 3, Why Should We Care If China Has the World's Biggest Navy? And our guest is Captain Brent Sadler, U.S. Navy retired. Brent is a foreign area officer in the Navy for the Indo-Pacific. He was, when I was the senior defense official defense attaché for Jim down in Australia, Brent was doing the same job in Malaysia. He is now a senior research fellow for Naval Warfare and Advanced Technology at the Heritage Foundation, and the author of an important book, The U.S. Naval Power in the 21st Century, where Brent takes on the very questions that we are talking about today. So, Brent, China has the world's biggest navy. Why should we care?
Well, it's, you know, technically, if you go back to 2015, that's when they crossed the threshold and unseated the United States to having the largest Navy, and that includes modern warships, and by saying largest modern Navy. So it's been some time since they've had a modern Navy. It's going to get bigger. I think by the end of the decade, they're going to be well over 400 ships. So they're not slowing down. And it's a couple of interesting things. Maybe we'll get into, like, what does it mean for them sustaining this large Navy? But why does it matter? First and foremost, that large of a modern Navy gives the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party in Beijing a lot of options that they can exercise Chinese power all over the world if they choose. So upwards of 370 warships today, they can send to the farthest corners of the world to as a show of the flag or to underlie diplomatic messages and initiatives. They can also use it to strong arm those that don't comply with Chinese interest, like we're seeing in the South China Sea, but also further afield off the Horn of Africa, if they so choose.
I'm going to try and put on my PLAN admiral hat and try and answer the question of why they need such a large Navy from their point of view. So what they say is we are dependent on global trade, and we're hemmed in by U.S. allies and forces along the first island chain. We've seen U.S. blockade and create sanctions against countries they don't like. We need this power to push back. So how do you respond to that?
No, absolutely. So partly, if you have a global economy, you're going to have a global Navy. It's the nothing more Mahanian in nature. And that's, you know, one of the godfathers of modern naval, I guess, ideology or philosophy or just maritime statecraft is Mahan. And so it's natural. It's history bears that out. But what's important is to understand the nature of the Chinese Communist Party. It's a party-controlled military. It's not a military that answers to the will of the people or representative of the Chinese country. It is an arm of the Chinese Communist Party. And so what is the Chinese Communist Party about is what the People's Liberation Army's Navy is going to do. And that's where the rub is. So a larger Navy, if it was a free and open economy, a democracy that had common interests and common principles, then there probably wouldn't be too much of a problem. We have disagreements with the French all the time, and they're a democracy, have common interests and common ideals. But the nature of our differences with the Chinese Communist Party are much more harsh. One is Taiwan, which is an unsettled issue from the Chinese Civil War. That would be a fight that would draw the United States in and its and our allies. And so a bigger navy makes that more likely, not less, because the Chinese have greater confidence. The other thing that really matters of why a larger navy is a concern when it's a Chinese Communist Party navy is the fact that the Chinese are using their military to elbow out or to underlie economic statecraft and to elbow out the United States and other Western countries from market space as well as for influence. And that influence isn't always respective of the will of the people in the home country. And I think we're seeing this going to play out in Solomon Islands, where there's a secret pact was signed for security agreement, where if the people of the Solomon Islands protest against the current prime minister, the Chinese could be called in to help suppress it. It'll be a litmus test if that happens. And again, a navy can move and sustain itself for a long time at great distances from the homeland. And so if the Chinese want to exercise more influence and power in the Solomon Islands, it's going to be the navy that's going to enable that. And so big navies enable a lot of good behavior, but also a lot of bad behavior if it's done for the wrong reasons. And that's the rub. We have a lot of differences, very deep differences in interest from the Chinese Communist Party.
So what we saw from the Houthis basically able to blockade the Bab al-Shiraz and our Navy unable to maintain the free flow of commerce through there. What does that say about navies, that we can't defeat this ragtag group?
Yeah, so it's there's a lot of lessons from what the Houthis are doing right now. And again, it's really the Iranians that are behind it. And so the Iranians are really probably the benefactors, as well as the Chinese as a second order effect. So one thing, Russian shipping, Chinese shipping has been going through largely unmolested by the Houthis. The Houthis can't shoot straight, so that's based on bad targeting as well as bad intelligence as to who they're and what their targets should be. So they have shot and they've damaged ships that they probably wouldn't have intended to. So there is that. But nonetheless, what I think the Chinese and the Russians are learning also is when you start to impact a shipping strait in any meaningful way, even if it's just focused in on a small group, or a targeted nationality, the effects are systematic. And so that, I think, is playing out. And even if the United States was able to, and I think it has kept the shipping that has gone through, they've been able to respond fairly effectively, but they haven't stopped the attacks. And so the insurance rates are high. Shipping companies are rerouting around Africa. And I think now we're 6 months into this war between Hamas and Israel. And I think the markets, the shipping industries have largely adjusted to this new reality. And if they feel so compelled, they've already baked in the added time and cost to go around Africa. So I think the shocks are mitigated now because the system is adjusted. But if something should happen to the Straits of Hormuz, and that's the Iranians more directly. And we got a little reminder of this in the hours before the attacks, the Iranian attacks on Israel on Saturday, when the ship Ares was captured by the Iranians. Now, that's a Portuguese-flagged vessel with a multinational crew. Again, the largest number of the people on there are Filipino. But Portugal is a NATO member country, and attacking a NATO member flagship, you would think that would elicit a strong response.
Yeah, that was rather disappointing, the response so far. But it's also disappointing that we can't secure that strait with our power in around Yemen. And I don't know what that says about naval power.
China has this big navy. So what? Does the big navy mean they have a capable navy? I mean, the U.S. has had the biggest navy in the world for a long time, and we're kind of used to having sea control wherever we want it. How much does it matter that they have the biggest navy when it comes to simple, raw, hard power? you know, in case of conflict.
Yeah, let's focus it first on, let's say, the most likely, if I mean not the most certain, but the most likely of major wars that's before us, and that's a conflict over Taiwan, the future of Taiwan, and one in which the Chinese Communist Party decides that the only way to resolve its dispute across the Taiwan Straits is through force of arms. The odds of that are not zero, but if that happens, you're going to have major war. And so numbers have a huge value when you get into conflict. Mass matters, both in the mass of munitions, when you're trying to overwhelm a defender's defenses and take out their targets. Mass matters. And we saw the Iranians try this on Saturday with massive missile attack, drone attack on Israel. Doesn't always work, but mass is important. The other thing where this large Navy, so from those large numbers of ships, you can deploy a large number of missiles and artillery and torpedoes. And so that gives you not only the ability to execute mass fires, but also to execute those from different vectors of attack. So different directions. You can attack your adversary from the left and the right, the front and the back, top and the bottom. It allows you other avenues to try to overwhelm your adversary. So, and you get that from numbers. The other thing that numbers give the Chinese Navy is they don't put all their eggs in too few baskets. And so for the U.S. Navy, if it lost a nuclear submarine or an Arleigh Burke destroyer, that's not just a tactical or something that you can mitigate. It becomes campaign impacting in a war. Say a campaign to retake a certain island or to reinsert forces into, say, Southeast Asia, that's a campaign. And so if you lose a ship, you could jeopardize the entire military effort. The Chinese, they could lose a frigate, they could lose a couple destroyers, they could lose a submarine or two. That will not imperil their military operations like it will for the U.S. What should be a tactical loss or tactical valued asset now takes on, with fewer numbers, a strategic value. And the United States then has to take much higher care and be much more circumspect in how it employs its military, which buys you into a long and very bloody war. And that's the danger.
But, you know, let's follow up on that. And as a landlubber, I'll ask a question you probably won't like. With persistent overhead satellite imagery, long-range missiles, drone swarms, undersea capabilities of vast distances, maybe surface vessels are just too vulnerable now. And this is a waste of money and time by the Chinese.
Yeah. Now, so as a submariner, I mean, I view all ships as targets. So for most of my career, you know, sneaking up on surface ships was kind of like a fun pastime, quite frankly. And so there is a truth to what you say. And add in the Chinese anti-ship ballistic missiles, which was a Soviet idea, the 70s, that they perfected with modern technology. Now, it's never been tried in actual conflict. So it's an untested. It's as untested as the aircraft carrier was before Toronto, when the Brits attacked the Italians, or before Pearl Harbor. It was really an untested platform in the test of arms. So with that uncertainty over all of these new things, swarm drones, anti-ship cruise missiles launched from land, which are being proven in combat, by the way, right now by Ukraine and Russia, and the Houthis, it's still not sure how it will play out, you know, modern versus modern major power warfare. The Houthis are not the Chinese, is kind of what I'm saying on that. So what does a nation like the United States and any prudent military power do? They hedge their bets. And the way you hedge your bets is you have your legacy systems and you bring on new systems in parallel, and you try to work out how these would work together in conflict. You also try to work out the bugs in the system of the new weapon systems. But until they're actually tested in conflict, placing your bets on the new next thing is a dangerous, risky proposition. And it hasn't always played out well for those that have. Some have like taken huge odds and have played off greatly for them. But I don't think we have to do that for the U.S.
Let me ask a quick follow-up. So I'm going to guess that part of the Chinese plan is the idea that quantity has a quality all its own, and this can be used to intimidate. No one's going to want to come up against that vast force. It's really not in their neighborhood. And even we are having second thoughts, certainly, given our reactions. So this intimidation tactic seems pretty successful in the South China Sea. But now we're pushing back, as we discussed last week, with the trilateral with the Philippines and Japan. Where does this lead?
Well, the biggest concern, and this goes back like to 2010 for me, and that was where we were setting our red lines were like somewhere up here, where our interests were viewed, where we could give ground and territory and or interest, because it really wasn't that important. We had so many other things, so much other advantages. So our red lines were like way up here. And so the Chinese had all this space down here to press their interest. And so what they've done over the last 20 years in the South China Sea is they've actually pressed and they have inserted a presence that's setting new norms and standards in the South China Sea. But eventually they are going to run up, and they have run up to U.S. interest. We have security treaties with the Philippines. The things that are happening around Second Thomas Shoal in the last few years, I wouldn't say just recently, it's starting to rub up against U.S. interests that we can no longer back away from. The danger is if the United States continued on a path where we were backing away from, we would eventually be in a corner where the only possible response would be conflict. So by acting now while things are still at play, the Chinese haven't gone kinetic against an ally of the United States. There's still room to push and pull and to work to try to define what this new environment is. And that's what's happening. It's a dance between the United States and China on the world stage to figure out where the bounds are. And we're just now becoming a part of the dance. The Chinese have been involved in this really since the early 90s, but most meaningfully, at least since maybe the early 2000s. And we're only in the last few years starting to get active in this and push back and engage the Chinese.
So Brent, I mean, you sort of went to the, you know, talking about the South China Sea. On a day-to-day basis, the issue there is not the Navy. It is their coast, it is the China Coast Guard, it's the maritime militia, which are being used to conduct things that we would associate with paramilitary activity, right? Are we sort of, you know, whistling past the graveyard a little bit by overlooking the fact that actually their military plus paramilitary numbers may be even, you know, of an order of magnitude even bigger than, well, maybe an order of magnitude's overstating it, but a lot bigger than even what we're counting now?
No, absolutely. In fact, I make a point. There's a graphic that I have that actually layers on the Chinese Coast Guard and the maritime militia as a comparison to fleet to fleet. For that very reason, because there's two fights going on. There is the new Cold War that we're in with the Chinese. That's the peacetime competition or rivalry, and then there is the potential for a hot war. So there's the preparation and all that goes into preparation for a major global war, and there is the here and now trying to win without firing a shot kind of competition that's going on. And you have to win both, and you have to play actively in both. And so I think you're right. The United States has not had an appreciation for what really the Chinese are doing in the South China Seas. Just keep it focused on just the South China Sea. The Chinese have focused in on trying to change the behavior of the claimant states, the five claimant states, and by de facto recognize their, I guess, authority and their power over all of the waters of South China Sea. This is the nine dash line. It's like they had already been doing things for a while actively to set that condition before even they formally acknowledged the nine dash line and put it out to the UN, to the United Nations. So, some would characterize what the Chinese have been doing if you buy into the notion that the U.S. is supporting a rules-based order, that what the Chinese have been doing in the South China Sea is in effect a maritime insurgency against that very said rules-based order, because an insurgency is focused on the people to shift their allegiance or their behaviors or their acknowledgement of who is the authority from one center to the other. So it fits. And Hunter Stires was like the light bulb on this, because all other ways of thinking all kind of line up. And the center of gravity shifts in Washington, D.C. from the Chinese in Beijing to the people that are fishing and who are doing the survey operations on the South China Sea. So it shifts the center of gravity. And I think it's clear that some leadership, and it's both Republican and Democrat, are starting to see that through that lens. And I think that's important, is that acknowledgement first, that in order to contest the Chinese below the level of conflict and actually try to adjust and ensure U.S. interests are being assured and advanced in Southeast Asia, we have to embrace a maritime counterinsurgency in the South China Sea. And that opens up different questions, and I think gets to your point about platforms.
I just wanted to just note, since you gave him a shout out, Hunter Stires at the U.S. Naval Institute and their Maritime Counterinsurgency Initiative, which has been going on for quite some time. So we'll make sure we mention that in the show notes.
So this isn't deterrence in the traditional sense you're talking about. This is something really different.
So when I first read Hunter Stires, he wrote an article called South China Sea Needs a Coin Toss, and coin is counterinsurgency. And he laid out a historical context. So I had actually spent a lot of time debating and working when I was at Paycom from 2012 to 15 on the rebalance. And I was trying to fight in this space, trying to get the United States to realize the nature of this competition. And so, not being all that successful, Hunter Stires, it flipped like a light bulb. And so I went to the Army doctrine. I actually went and I read Army counterinsurgency doctrine. Again, I did it at National War College. And what I did is I took that eureka moment and I grafted it into an Army person's understanding of a land-based counterinsurgency. And I said, it's all the same. So you talk about, you know, protecting the people and that you're trying to protect villages and you're trying to ensure that the people acknowledge the authority of the central government and the capital. That's the same thing as ensuring that fishermen, you know, in the middle of the South China Sea are acknowledging that they can fish inside their country's EEZ waters and that's where they're fishing. That if a Coast Guard vessel from another country comes into it, that there is going to be a response from the host, from the other country in which they're coming into, to as the authority of that water, and that they should move away from it. So it all grafted very nicely. And a lot of the Army folks, when I first started talking about this with them, they said, that's impossible. It's a land thing. And they said, no, look at your doctrine. And then I walked through the example of fishermen going after natural resources on the seabed, and then how that impacted governments. And then the light bulb went off too. So, I mean, Hunter Stires was onto something, and it's been very helpful, I think, in the debate here in DC.
Well, so first of all, I'm going to want to know how much Hunter gave you to give him so many shout outs in a single podcast. But we'll have to give him hell about that later.
Yeah.
But I mean, so really important concept. And, you know, I think one of the points that I've seen made over on that site is, as people have written for the Maritime Counterinsurgency Project, is that, you know, it matters. In fact, were you the one who wrote the article on a man with a gun?
No, that wasn't me. I did write one of the first articles for the counterinsurgency piece.
But, you know, but just sort of the idea that when a Filipino fisherman or Vietnamese trawler looks out and sees a maritime militia ship or a group of maritime militia ships or Coast Guard vessels coming at them, there's nobody there to protect them.
That's right.
You know, the United States may be able to steam through a carrier battle group once in a while, and that's always a really impressive thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do, we are... You know, we are serious business, and nobody would want to mess with that. But then we're gone, and we're off to the next thing. You know, we're on our way out the other, you know, through the Malacca Strait, and we're going to the Indian Ocean. And now they're still looking out, and they're seeing nothing but Chinese vessels, and it's not the Navy. And so, you know, I mean, we're now looking at the fact that China has been able, through its, you know, not only building out these paramilitary forces, But then also building out these bases, these artificial island bases from which they can stage them. So now when the Philippines wants to take a resupply vessel from Palawan out to Second Thomas Shoal, China has 30 kilometers from Second Thomas Shoal, a major military installation at Mischief Reef from which it can simply push out the blockade. And, you know, and what is the Philippines supposed to show up with at that point?
Yes. Yeah, so I've had this conversation with a lot of folks, including Hunter, and what I've been noticing for the last year or so, and it's not a surprise. This goes back to a discussion back in 2014 and 15 about what comes next from these man-made garrisons, these Chinese man-made garrisons in South China Sea. The Chinese are going, as they rely more and more on a conventional approach in the South China Sea, they are going to be the ones running a counterinsurgency themselves. And so what you're seeing now as they try to project themselves out in the Second Thomas Shoal is the tables are somewhat turned. The roles are slightly reversed. But in other places, the Chinese are still kind of running an insurgency like they're doing at Scarborough Shoal. It's not quite shifted to a conventional approach for them yet. So it's dynamic and it's not uniform. It's not China is all the insurgent all over the South China Sea anymore. It's dynamic based on the feature and who's got a garrison and who's got more of authority or more of a presence. So it's dynamic. But your point about the U.S. not being present, that's been hammering at that since 2000 for a long time, even before 2010, when I got really involved in this space. I have argued for quite some time, even during the rebalance work, so well before my time in Malaysia, for a first fleet, because the Navy's not structured for having a focused command executing a campaign in Southeast Asia. Now, a large part of that's going to be at sea, but a large part of this is also through economic development in concert with the foreign service officers, the embassies throughout the region. And this is where maritime statecraft or naval statecraft enter into the discussion, because if you're just simply trying to exercise military operations that support maritime counterinsurgency to establish and maintain the authorities of a rules-based order, it's not going to be sustainable. There has to be also an economic piece to this as well, and it starts at the ports. And so there's that piece of this as well. So if you can safeguard more Malaysian fishermen to be off South Laconia Shoal, let's set aside energy resources and seabed extraction type stuff and just look at fishing. So if you can enable more Malaysian fishermen to go out and benefit from fishing by port investments and also small loans, microloans, and other things like that, that grows the local waterfront communities. They can go out and now they're more of a presence. The more of a presence that they have, that also carries the authority with them that's their area. And so the mass, again, it's another interesting twist to how mass has a quality or a value. And while I'm not necessarily advocating for more Malaysian fishermen, there are other countries like the Philippines and Vietnam who do have fishing communities that are under pressure from competition and who do suffer from the consequences of the Chinese activities in the region.
Well, I agree. It would be an amazing demonstration of U.S. resolve and commitment to the region. And I, given the cost and the current climate in Washington, it's hard to see. Yeah. Maybe back a decade or so ago. But in the interim, I guess the question is, deterrence isn't working. China continues on, except to the point that, for instance, the Sierra Madre remains and is occasionally resupplied. Scarborough Shoal, the fishermen are kept out. Sometimes they sneak in. So it's sort of a cat and mouse game. At what point does a water cannon or other non-modern attack on a Philippine naval vessel require the triggering of our mutual defense treaty?
That's a very good question. And I don't know that there's a good answer. We need to have a better answer that's publicly known. Right now, it's just, you know, if you damage or you harm or interfere with Philippine, you know, official like Coast Guard and naval vessels, that would trigger the defense treaty. But we never really define that, or we never really give much color to what those words mean. That ambiguity will only go so far.
Yeah, I actually have been asked that question, you know, given my work with the Philippines. I get asked that question a lot.
Oh, yes.
Probably almost after almost every single water cannon event or ramming or anything like this. Interestingly, President Marcos just about a day ago came out and said that if a Philippine sailor were killed, that would trigger the treaty. Which actually I was surprised that he said that, because it would appear to be sort of drawing the red line, which has implications, right? You know, I mean, we tend to be somewhat ambiguous about this, in part because we're concerned about the red line, that what it commits us to, but also because we know that if you draw the red line, then all of a sudden you've kind of erected the permission structure for China to go all the way up to that.
Yes.
Right. So it's got its downsides.
No, I've heard that. I've heard similar discussions. And I'm not sure that they should have, I mean, the MMCA, which is this dialogue about maritime incidents at sea with the PLAN that we've had for quite some time, that would be the venue to raise this, I think. And that should be very clear. And when I was in uniform, it wasn't clear that our messages were always getting through. So we have to hammer it repeatedly. So it delivered through the MMCA through uniform military channels, but then it has to be hammered through our diplomatic corps all over the world, wherever the Chinese are with that point, to make sure they hear the same message of what it is. Similar things with the Senkaku Islands. When President Obama went with Prime Minister Abe there in 2014, I think it was 13 or 14. He basically said, hey, if the Chinese attack or have a presence on the Senkaku Islands, that will trigger the US-Japan defense guidelines, the alliance. So because we acknowledge that they administer it, and since the Japanese administer it, that's Japanese territory. That's the kind of clarity that the Chinese needed.
Yeah, and just again, because I'm sort of close to the Philippines on this,
yeah.
The Philippines noticed that President Obama was not quite so clear when it came to Scarborough Shoal, and that was, I think, an error that we have since, yeah, we as a country, the United States, has since corrected.
Mm-hmm.
And not just Scarborough Shoal, but the entire West Philippine Sea. You know, now every single time that one of these things happens, we clarify that all public vessels operating in the South China Sea, are subject to the Mutual Defense Treaty. But no, back then we were not so clear. And when we made it clear with Japan, a lot of the Philippine, society looked at it and said, hey, what about us?
Oh, yes. No, with that in mind, I looked at the public releases that came from Secretary of Defense on this topic, because he had a meeting also with Marcos and also with the president's post-meeting summit statement. And both of them said exactly the same words. And they said an attack or aggression against Philippine vessels anywhere in the South China Sea will trigger the Mutual Defense Treaty. So they were consistent, and that's good. But I'm not sure it's enough. There's probably some room, because we're not talking about the Chinese occupying a specific geographic feature, which assumes a level of violence in doing that. In this case, we're talking about harassment. And that's a lot harder. Defining what harassment would trigger a defense treaty, there's a little bit more art in that than the Senkakus. But
sure,
there's been a lot, I'd have to say, I mean, in the last 5-7 years, things have moved a long way in the right direction with regards to the Mutual Defense Treaty with the Philippines.
So I'm going to try to move this along, just because we've sort of got into a South China Sea discussion, and I want to kind of get us back to the size of the Chinese Navy relative to ours. And you've had some things to say in recent months about, and actually years, about the size of our Navy and our ability to produce ships. What are your concerns when it comes to U.S. shipbuilding, and whether or not we're going to be able to not keep up with the Chinese Navy, but even just keep up with what we've got out there now?
Yeah. So the first problem is the Navy is accelerating to retirement, like mandatory retirement. Too many of the ships are relics of the 90s, even the Cold War era. And so they're past their useful lives and they need to be retired. But the problem is we're not building fast enough. But we're going to get to a point to where these ships are just, they're just not able to operate anymore. And we're starting to see that. More breakdowns, more delays for ships getting on deployment. So that's a problem. That's just the reality. And the next part of that is our shipyards. We don't have enough public shipyards. And therefore, we had 8 at the end of the Cold War. And we did base realignment closure of 4 of them. We need to have 2 of those probably back. At a minimum, we need 5, one more in the Pacific coast, to maintain the nuclear submarines and the nuclear aircraft carriers that we have. And if the emphasis has been on the nuclear submarine force as the asymmetric advantage against, or what we'll use to fight against any Chinese onslaught in the Western Pacific, we're not investing in the infrastructure to sustain those. So that's in the shipyard piece, that's priority. That's a number one priority. The second is maintenance. We haven't been able to attract enough shipyard workers, and we don't have enough commercial shipyards to maintain, like, our destroyers. We're building frigates, but once they come out in numbers, are we going to have enough places all over the United States where they can get repaired, not just the yard that's building them? Because the yard that builds them is usually not the one that maintains and does the repairs, just because you want to keep producing. So that's another problem. We don't have enough shipyard workers. And then this one's really kind of interesting. But when I started digging into this problem and trying to get to root causes years ago, we also don't have enough naval architects in-house in the Navy. So the naval architects are the engineers that when a chief of naval operations or a joint staff makes a recommendation or a requirement to change certain specifications on a ship design, if you don't have enough naval architects in uniform or inside the Department of Defense, changes to the design can be requested that come with great cost, unexpected cost, and also great delays. And so part of what's happening is the Navy specifically is not a very well-informed customer. And that's also got to get fixed by having more naval architects. So none of that's going to happen overnight. You got to do all of it, quite frankly. It's not a choice of one than the other. You got to do all those things now to basically fix the problems with naval shipbuilding. The other thing is you can't really get a sustainable fix unless the United States becomes a maritime nation once again. We have less than 200 U.S. flag ships. The industry that supports that it's gone. It's effectively a non-player in the world marketplace. And it's not that the United States needs to compete at the caliber of the Japanese, the South Koreans, and the Chinese in shipbuilding and shipping. But it needs to have more than a 0.0%, 0.01% of the overall shipping in the world. We just can't sustain ourselves if we get in a big crisis with a country like China. So it's a strategic dilemma for the United States, and there are no easy answers.
So how does AUKUS feed into this? We promised a delivery of subs, Virginia subs,
yep.
But maybe they could help with maintenance in their shipyards or something like that.
So for that, I'm a big proponent for AUKUS. My introduction to AUKUS was like three in the morning of the day of the announcement. And because I had there's been similar ideas in the past that I had been involved in or I was advising on, I put my ideas of how AUKUS could go forward. And by and large, it's kind of happening along that way. Australia provides a huge strategic opportunity to help solve a problem for the United States. One, the United States is really the only one that can build submarines for Australia in the future. The Brits maybe, but they have capacity problems worse than the United States. But the United States, if the Australians invest in that naval shipbuilding infrastructure now, then we can grow our capacity and make more submarines to include what the Australians buy. The other thing that Australia offers, though it's still about 3,000 miles away from where the most likely war would be over Taiwan and South China Sea, it's still a lot closer than Hawaii and certainly further away from Chinese missiles than bases in Yokosuka, Japan, and Sasebo. So it offers a forward base for doing nuclear maintenance, battle damage repair if a war occurred. And having that option outside of Guam is really, really strategically important. So having Australia invest in and develop a domestic naval nuclear program is in the United States' best interest too. It's a win-win for both countries. But Australia has a huge bill in front of it. They have to make that big down payment now, because if they don't, then the U.S. submarine shipbuilding will not be able to grow to meet what Congress is mandating and funding to grow the Navy's own submarine force. So without a substantial infusion of capital investment, this may be dead before it gets off the ground. But just to reiterate, AUKUS has huge potential to be a strategic boon for both Canberra and DC.
Well, so Jim, we're probably going to have to draw this to a close. But I will say, you know,
I'm having fun, Ray.
I will say that, you know, from our time, you know, all three of us have experienced this. You know, going back to Brent's point about naval statecraft, there is nothing quite like having an aircraft carrier pull up outside of the country that you're trying to build a relationship with, gather up a whole bunch of their senior officials, put them aboard a C-2, and fly them out for an arrested landing aboard a U.S. aircraft carrier. In order to sort of, you know, bring home American power and what we bring to the fight, it is truly a spectacle. I think that when I was able to bring together the project to get a number of Australian officials, including the Prime Minister, out to the USS Ronald Reagan, and Jim, as you know, the ambassador who succeeded you there in Australia was a big Ronald Reagan fan and a former Reagan administration official, and loved him some Ronald Reagan. I think after that event, I probably could have burned the embassy to the ground, and he still would have forgiven me. Those flyouts out to the aircraft carrier, it is still an amazing sight. It is still a very impressive thing, and it carries a lot of weight. And if China is able to start doing things like that as well, I would think that, you know, China would be able to sort of really up its naval statecraft game. Brent?
No, I don't disagree. But their system and my engagements with the PLA officers of all is that they are hamstrung by a political system that's going to basically not allow them to take full advantage of all the things that they could offer. And that's an advantage that we have, that their system's just not going to enable. I mean, I could be surprised, but I look at the use of like the peace arc, and it doesn't always work out very well for, and oftentimes it backfires on them. The peace arc is like a hospital ship that the Chinese took from our use of like our own hospital ships that we would deploy around and do medical procedures for folks. Most notably, one of the stories about having eye doctors look at patients in Tunisia and fixing cataracts, and it's like life-changing, but fairly low cost and life-changing impact. The Chinese have not really fully embraced it in a way that leaves a enduring positive impression. So maybe they're changing on that, but not from my knowledge.
That'd be great if we had more hospital ships to go along with their aircraft carriers.
Yeah.
Well, Brent, thank you. This has been just really outstanding. We're going to go ahead and wrap this up by thanking you for joining us. We want to really encourage people to follow your work. So what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, if you just go on LinkedIn for Brent Sadler, that's probably the place to get the most meaningful, deep writing. And of course, at BD Sadler, you can get me on X. That's another place you can find me. But then at Heritage, if you go to heritage.org and just look me up, Brent Sadler, you can find me there and all the recent events and everything else that I'm doing in the public space.
And of course, if you want to read about U.S. naval power in the 21st century, we should absolutely go out and get that book right there. Very good. All right. So for our audio podcast listeners, you might have guessed that he held up a copy of his book.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, Brent. Thanks for joining us. And Jim and I will be back in just a second to tell our war stories.
All right. Well, thanks. Both of you guys are doing great work, and I enjoy following both of you guys out there in the social media, and all the work you're doing is great. Thanks.
All right. We're going to start a new feature that Ray mentioned at the top, where I was, what I was doing, how I impacted the global universe way back when. So we'll put on our cozy cardigans and our fuzzy slippers, light our pipes, and tell stories to each other. And since this was Ray's idea, you're going to go first. So what story are you going to share with everyone, Ray?
All right. And we're calling this There I Was. And for those of us who are in the Air Force, even though I did not fly in the Air Force, there's sort of the old joke about the Air Force pilots, and they're holding up their hands because pilots always have to talk with their hands. They can say, there I was. I was, you know, upside down and taking his picture and all that stuff. So, but there I was actually working for Jim Caruso in Australia, and I had just arrived as the brand new defense attaché. And I tell you, when I got to Australia, what I knew about Australia was Crocodile Dundee and kangaroos and Joint Strike Fighters. Everything in Australia wants to kill you, and something about Bloomin' Onions and Outback Steakhouse. That was pretty much my level of knowledge about Australia. But
I'm glad I didn't know that at the time.
Yes, well, I'm sure you would have hired me had you known. But I mean, I did have my charm and my good looks. So I got there, and immediately we went into this major exercise called Talisman Sabre, where we bring tens of thousands of troops to Australia. It's Australia's largest exercise. It's every 2 years. It's biannual. And so I was, you know, actually you and I, Jim, went out to on a CV-22 mission to visit an amphib, I believe, and so it was a very exciting time, a lot going on, but at the end of the exercise, tragically, a V-22, a CV-22, a Marine Corps CV-22, went down off the coast of Queensland. And three Marines were unable to get out of the aircraft and went to the bottom of the ocean. And it was an awful, tragic thing. And the Australians just really impressively leapt into motion because they wanted to do their part. And so immediately I get a phone call from the First Assistant Secretary for International Policy. And he says, look, Minister Maurice Payne wants to talk to Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis immediately.
As a defense minister.
The Minister of Defense, Maurice Payne. And so can you get Secretary Mattis on the phone because we want to be able to help? And they had already put the dive ship underway. They were already, you know, way out in front, but she of course wanted to be able to express condolences and ask what Australia could do to help. And I said, okay, absolutely. And of course, so this is my first big crisis as defense attaché, and I pull out my phone, and I realize when I got there, they kind of wiped my phone and they gave me a brand new phone. So I didn't have any of the phone numbers of my predecessor in my phone. And so I didn't know how to call anybody. And so, you know, I'm sort of sitting there staring at this phone thinking, well, how should I even start this process of trying to get the Secretary of Defense of the United States on the phone with the Minister of Defense from Australia? So I had worked at the Pentagon long enough to sort of know who was who in the zoo. And I started by calling the Pentagon switchboard because I could find them in the yellow pages, basically. You know, you can find the Pentagon switchboard. So I called the Pentagon switchboard, and I knew that I couldn't just ask for the Secretary of Defense's number. So I asked them to connect me to the National Military Command Center. But I didn't say that. Just like our guest, I used military acronyms. So I said, can you connect me to the NMCC? And they said, I'm sorry, we don't know what that is. And I said, this is the Pentagon switchboard, right? Because I just thought, you know, if you're at the Pentagon, you probably know what the National Military Command Center is. It's a pretty major part of the Pentagon. But anyway, I spelled it out for them, and they looked around and they said, well, we're not really sure which of these phone numbers you'd want to talk to. So I finally said, well, the emergency action cell has people in it all the time. There's always somebody there at the phone. They found that phone number, so they connected me there. I managed to sort of leap through a couple of other, you know, can you get me to this office? Can you get me to this office? And I kept getting closer and closer to the secretary's office. And a few minutes later, I actually had the secretary's scheduler on the phone. And he says, oh, well, actually, that's you've got good timing because Secretary Mattis is about to walk in the door. I'm expecting him in probably the next 5 minutes. So, of course, I called back to the First Assistant Secretary for International Policy in Australia. And I said, yeah, I've got it. No problem. You know, I was able to get Secretary Mattis on the phone. Can you get the minister on the phone in the next, say, 5 or 10 minutes? Because, you know, that I'm so well connected that I was able to get this whole thing solved for you in a few minutes. He had no clue that I had started the process by calling the Pentagon switchboard.
And that's what makes us a superpower, right?
The envy of the world, Jim. The envy of the world. All right. Well, Jim, this has always been, this is always fun. For our listeners, thank you for joining us. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Brent Sadler. I hope you'll you'll join us for the next one. I think we're going to be talking about China's cyber aggression with another really exciting guest. We'll have to get the first war story coming from Jim. In the meantime, if you like our podcast, we ask you to subscribe. That way you won't miss one. Please tell your friends and make sure you give us a glowing 5-star review on Apple iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And until next time, which I think will be pretty soon, we thank you for joining us.